On This Week in Enterprise Tech, we have Mr. Brian Shee, Mr. Chris Franklin back on the show today. China is being blocked by multiple U.S. agencies on imports and exports, as well as selling tech. Cyber attacks by spoofing Google Translate using unique phishing attacks, plus super clouds with our fabulous guest, Lori McVitie from F5. Definitely shouldn't miss it. Quiet on the set.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is TWiT, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 515, recorded October 14th, 2022. Supercloud Unmasked. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by IT Pro TV. If you're looking to break into the world of IT, or if your IT team needs to level up, get the introduction you need with IT Pro TV. Check out an IT Pro TV business plan by visiting itpro.tv/enterprise today. And by Melissa. Make sure your customer contact data is up to date. Try Melissa's APIs in the developer portal. It's easy to log on, sign up, and start playing in the API sandbox 24/7. Get started today with 1,000 records cleaned for free at melissa.com/twit. Welcome to TWiT, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that is dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and that geek who just wants to know how this world's connected. I'm your host, Louis Maresca, your guide through this big world of the enterprise. But I can't guide you by myself. I need to bring in the professionals and the experts, starting with our very own Mr. Brian Cheese, net architect at Sky Fiber, network expert, security expert, all-around tech geek. He does everything. Cheebert, how are you doing, my friend? What's keeping you busy this week?
What's keeping me busy is some really good drugs, trying to get my back to unloosen and stop twinging every time I move around too much. It's like, wow, I am getting old. I hate this.
Yeah. Well, you got a lot of walking to do, right? I mean, the convention center for Maker Faire is big, right?
Well, it's actually at the fairgrounds, Central Florida Fairgrounds. But yeah, I'm going to be doing a lot of walking. So this is going to be an event where I really wish I had gotten further on that electric cart that I want to build. I was going to do an electric cupcake. But since I didn't make it for the fair, maybe I'm going to make a small version of a 1942 Ford Woody, maybe. That'd be fun.
Very nice. Very nice. Yeah. My kid's been trying to push me to buy some, those, you know, they're pretty cheap electric motors, you know, $150 or whatever for a high wattage motor on, you know, obviously to get the batteries. But they want me to build something like that too. And I was like, oh, with the time that I have, sure.
Yeah. The motors aren't the hard part. The hard you know, the expensive part are the batteries. That's why I recommend to anyone that wants to do this, take a look at Jehu Garcia, J-E-H-U Garcia. He's also known as Jag35 on Facebook. His company actually survives on recycling batteries and teaching people how to build their own power walls and power packs and, you know, electric bicycles and stuff like that. So they actually recycle old laptop battery packs, split them open, test the batteries, get, you know, recycle the bad ones, and then resell the good ones. So you could have a battery pack for an electric vehicle pretty cheaply if you're willing to spend some time on it.
Right. It's really cool. Really cool. Well, it's great having you here, Cheebert. Well, we also have to bring in a man of many talents as well. He has a pulse on security in the enterprise world, and he's our very own Mr. Curtis Franklin, senior analyst at Omdia. Curtis, it's always great to have you back. What's been keeping you busy this week?
Well, it's great to be here, Lou, and enjoying being in the middle of Cybersecurity Awareness Month. You know, October is Cybersecurity Awareness Month, so, you know, you have to get out all of your cybersecurity awareness costumes, get the decorations out, make plans for your cybersecurity awareness parades. It's a big deal, so, you know, everybody should be hauling out their cybersecurity awareness stuff, you know, holds off the decorations for those other holidays that come up for just a little while longer, because, you know, the big box stores are full of Cybersecurity Awareness Month decorations.
Don't you wish that awareness was that easy?
It would be wonderful. It would be wonderful. You know, I still love having neighbors who ask me about things because they will say, oh, I got this dodgy looking message. And so I sent an email back to the people who sent it to me, telling them that they should be ashamed. That was the right thing to do, wasn't it? He said, well, yeah, just stop talking to me about security. And, you know, for heaven's sakes, don't call me when all of your accounts disappear.
That's right.
No, just no.
Indeed. Well, thanks for being here, Curtis. You know, speaking of that, you know, they should be watching Twilight because we have a lot of awareness on this show. And in fact, speaking of awareness, you know, there's been a lot going on in the enterprise this week. Several new moves by the government agencies of the U.S. They're starting to actually impact China's technology expansion, exporting into the and exporting and importing in the U.S. So we'll talk a little bit about some of the moves that are going on there, what it actually means for the industry. But organizations are always asking us about cloud vendor lock-in, hybrid clouds, and of course, the big industry term of digital transformations. Well, today we have an expert on, Lori McVitie. She's distinguished engineer with F5, and we're going to learn the truth about it all and whether super clouds can become a real thing. Lots of exciting stuff to talk about here, so definitely stick around. But first, like we always do, we have some enterprise tech news to talk about here. So let's jump into this week's news blips. If you thought the chip industry was having supply issues, now just think about the near future. According to this Reuters article this past week, the U.S. Commerce Department passed a sweeping set of regulations aimed at kneecapping advancements in China's semiconductor industry. You may be thinking, how bad can it be? If it's enforced broadly, it can impact research and commercial data centers from using advanced AI chips. It could also prevent Chinese chip fabs from acquiring the necessary manufacturing equipment and having the potential to actually impact people's jobs at these companies, both foreign and domestic. And a calculated reply from the China Semiconductor Industry Association, they say, quote, not only will such a unilateral measure harm the further global supply chain of the semiconductor industry, but more importantly, it will create an atmosphere of uncertainty. That it will. Part of this could be due to China's civil-military fusion. U.S. national security is responding to China's pursuit of strategic dominance in economic sectors that are also critical for military modernization. Now, here are some of the controls the new regulation now holds when sending items of any sort to an integrated circuit fab in China whose production meets one of the three criteria. One, logic that's either non-planar or has a smallest feature size under 16 nanometer, dynamic random access memory with a smallest feature size under 18 nanometer, and through number three, producing or developing NAND flash memory. And there's also compliance reasons here. Compliance-wise, U.S. persons must either get licensed or confirm that their export to China isn't for these purposes. Now, as you can see, lots of blocking statements here and red tape thereafter to prevent loopholes. Now, the question is, will the United States R&D sector run fast enough to catch up to the technology gap this will actually create? And with the market on the downward trend and new regulations going into place, the bottom of the barrel still not in view. One hopes this is a fuel to a fire of innovation that will be required to level the playing field.
Researchers from Avanon, which is part of Checkpoint, have uncovered an ongoing phishing campaign that uses a common JavaScript coding technique to bypass email security scanners using Google Translate. According to an article on Dark Reading, it's an approach researchers haven't seen before, but worry they'll see again if it's at all successful in harvesting user credentials. In the attack, users receive an email message that gives an urgent message about responding to this message or risk having the account closed. Messages provide a link that directs the users to a credentials harvesting page that appears to be a legitimate Google Translate page with a pre-populated email field that requires only that the person enter their password to log in. In the blog post announcing the discovery, researchers wrote that the attack has a little bit of everything. A unique social engineering on the front end, leveraging a legitimate site to help it get into the inbox, and using trickery and obfuscation to confuse security services. The attacker's developers use the JavaScript unescape function to mask the true contents of the malicious web page. It's commonly used, but it can obfuscate the actual URL of the links in the message, URLs that really have nothing whatsoever to do with Google Translate. It's yet another reason to do most of your email opening on your computer, where the old hover over the link technique still does a pretty good job of showing you where the link actually goes, and where you can sit back, relax, and wonder why random people would know that your mailbox is full and about to be deleted if you don't act immediately.
All right, so this is an interesting image. So, Mr. Ant, if we could bring up that image. Everybody's seen these types of high-voltage towers all over the place. A lot of them go between cities or between neighborhoods or regions and whatever. They're carrying some very, very high voltage. Now, this isn't a story about power lines specifically. The blip today is more about the RF interference generated by high-voltage power lines and radio towers. So in a story from my buddies on the InteropNet team, where one of them was trying to troubleshoot a really odd error message on his Fluke LAN meter. This head scratcher wasn't found online or in any of the manuals, so he gave our friend Neil Allen, who was then with Fluke Networks, a call. Seems the error was odd enough that Neil had to look it up and came up with a question. Was he anywhere near a radio transmitter? Turning slowly around, he saw not far outside the window of the high-rise office building he was in, a white and red radio transmission tower. The moral of the story is that any network that uses a metallic conductor for its layer one, meaning the physical connection, can be affected by RF interference that, like those from high-voltage power lines or radio antennas. Just think back to those images of folks holding a fluorescent light tube up in the air below high voltage lines and seeing them light up without being connected to anything. The reality is, in some cases, you might need to shift to shielded twisted pair instead of normal Cat 6, or in some extreme cases, like what I had to do in engine rooms on board lots of ships, I've had to shift to fiber optics. One last story. Back in the day, Hawaiian Electric ran high-voltage power lines that had fiber optics in them. And what they did was they actually rented the dark fiber. The Bank of Hawaii in Honolulu loved this and had a direct connection from their main data center to their downtown office tower. Sadly, the Public Utilities Commission didn't like it and put the kibosh on the whole thing. Darn.
Crowdsourcing and funding is not just for podcasts and do-it-yourself projects anymore. It's also for distributed denial of service attacks as well. According to this Bleeping Computer article, a pro-Russian group created a crowdsourced project called DDoS-IA that pays volunteers launching distributed denial of service attacks against Western entities. Now, DDoS attacks are typically simple to carry out, but carry a lot of punch and impact. That's why they're the go-to weapon of hacktivists with individuals, groups, or even governments. Now, adding financial incentives to the process is a new strategy for hacker groups and government entities. Now, that means attackers don't have to believe in the cause anymore to actually partake in the dirty event. Project DDoS-IA was launched in mid-August by a group named NoName05716 that had emerged in March 2022. According to the reports, this group has been involved in DDoSing Ukrainian organizations, but was successful in just 40% of their attacks. Now, DDoS-IA launched on Telegram, where the operators shared a link to a GitHub page containing instructions for the volunteers that want to be to actually join. Now, the channel counts over 13,000 members today. Now, throughout its existence, that group aligned with the target set by the pro-Russian gang Killnet and contributed to the recent wave of DDoS attacks against large airports in the United States. Essentially, if you want to volunteer for the group, you're sent a zip file with the malware with a unique ID associated with it. Now, the link you actually link the ID to a crypto wallet, and that's how you get your money when you have a successful DDoS attack. Pretty crafty. They have a payment tier as well. That's right, different tiers. Top contributors in each attack wave receive about 80,000 rubles. Which was about $1,250. Second place attackers receive about $800. And third place contributors are compensated with around $300. Now, this is just another way for people to make a second income online, especially when repercussions are low, even if you're caught. If you haven't already, you might want to go and enable DDoS protection on your favorite cloud provider, or figure out ways to have distributed filtering scale on load and analyze and shut down traffic using those similar patterns out there. That means organizations have to start thinking about these things, even if they haven't yet happened to them. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Next up, we have a really great set of bites. But before we get to the bites, we do have to thank a really great sponsor of this week in Enterprise Tech, and that's IT Pro TV. Training is an important aspect of any organization. Your people want to grow. Plus, you want your people learning at the speed of the industry. I work in the industry, and I can tell you, even after 25 years, I still need to learn quickly every single day. Your IT team needs the skills and knowledge to ensure your business is a success. And with IT Pro TV, more than 80% of users who start a video finish it. IT Pro TV is engaging, and your team will enjoy learning on their platform. Give your team the tools they need to make your business thrive. Courses are entertaining and binge-worthy, keeping your team interested, invested in their learning. Now, the tech industry is evolving and rapidly changing. We all know that. Your team needs to be trained today. Now, when a new software is released, or there's a system upgrade or a cyber threat facing your business, IT Pro TV offers the training and perspective of those disruptions within days, if not hours, getting you up to speed faster than you've ever been before. You might be asking, why is IT Pro TV right for your business? Well, get all the training and certifications for your team done all in one place. IT Pro TV has every vendor skill you need for you, your IT team, and their training. They provide Microsoft IT training, Cisco training, Linux training, Apple training, security, cloud, and a ton of others. More than 1,500 hours ranging from technical skills to compliance to soft skills. You can do so much with an IT Pro TV business plan as well. Track your team's results. You can manage seats, assign and unsign team members, and access monthly usage reports, which are actually very useful for teams. See metrics like logins, viewing times, tracks completed, and much more. You can easily manage your teams. You can manage subsets of users or teams by providing them with customized assignments, monitoring progress, reporting on the usage platform. And assignments can be full courses, and they can also be individual episodes within those courses as well. Now, advanced reporting is also available. Get immediate insight into your team's viewing patterns and progress over any period of time with those visual reports. Don't forget, the IT Pro TV has individual plans too. Give your team the IT development platform they need to level up their skills while enjoying the journey. For teams of 2 to 1,000, go to itpro.tv/enterprise today. And we thank IT Pro TV for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's now time for the bites. Now, with new policies looming around commerce, blocking manufacturing and supply from China, additional events are happening across the government. We talked about it in the blips. Now we're going to talk about it here in the bites. And the controversies surrounding Huawei, it's not new, right? In fact, we actually had Huawei CSO Andy Purdy on the show back in episode 404 to help clean the air. But however, it seems that the FCC is about to move forward on a plan that might actually add additional challenges for Huawei in the U.S. According to this Ars Technica and Axios, they are actually expected to ban all sales of Huawei and ZTE telecom devices in the U.S. on the grounds of national security. That's right. The ban expands upon the ban already in place for Huawei and ZTE for being used in telecom networks that receive subsidies from the Universal Service Fund. Now, the FCC claims that the proposed order would actually update and strengthen its covered list and equipment rules. And in fact, it fulfills a statutory mandate that Congress imposed on the commission in the Secure Equipment Act of 2021. They also stated that this ban is not retroactive. So that means that companies can continue to sell products that the FCC has already approved. Now, the cover list is a list of communications equipment and services that are deemed to be posed an unacceptable risk to the national security of the United States or the security and safety of United States persons. Now, the new ban and list can be voted upon any time here, and it's already circulating around with the title Protecting Against National Security Threats to the Communications Supply Chain through the Equipment Authorization Program. Heck of a title. Now, Huawei and ZTE are not the only companies that will be impacted. In fact, the new proposal would actually ban video surveillance equipment from three Chinese companies. This Hytera, Hikvision, and Dahua. Now, the companies make products for the police departments. So the a question that comes to mind is if this already includes in consumer devices as well. That's a good question, right? Because obviously most radios and frequencies are already on an allow list. So we'll see how that will be actually impacted. I want to bring my co-host in here because, guys, this sounds like we're on our way down a slippery slope here. FCC has bans. Now Commerce is trying to place nails in the coffin, and FCC has more tactical punches here from other directions. It sounds like this is intended to send a clear global message. What do you guys think? What do you think, Curtis?
Well, I think clear global message is exactly what they're trying to send. This is something that deals far more with messaging than with actual tangible results on the ground, because most of our major carriers were already not using Huawei equipment. This takes a step further, meaning that pretty much every telecom of any size is going to be forbidden from using any Huawei or ZTE equipment. The one that gets interesting are some of these video surveillance things that go, in fact, in a lot of security implementations, a lot of law enforcement. There you start to get into a lot of small communities where the dollar amount is important. You know, it's not a question of, well, it's far better value, even though the outlay is higher for someone else. It's they just don't have the dollars. The fear is pretty clear. They have stated that it's a twofold fear. One is that elements of the Chinese military could use back doors in the equipment to do surveillance on American locations and systems. And the other is that in the event of a conflict, they could send what amount to kill codes to the equipment, shutting down American networks and now surveillance capabilities. What's going to be fascinating is seeing how far this goes. Anyone who has looked at the equipment coming out of China knows that there is a network of manufacturers over there, and it's going to be difficult to stop once they start. And you all of a sudden end up with a banned list that has scores, if not hundreds, of names on it. And that's going to start getting entertaining for a lot of large American vendors, like, say, Amazon, Walmart, and the rest.
Right. Well, Chibert, you know, obviously Huawei's been trying for a long time to get into this market. It seems like that's it. This is kind of like the nail in that coffin.
It's interesting. You know, I've had to deal with a banned product list for decades now, being in the federal government and doing a lot of work with the military. Heck, even Lenovo was on that list for a long time. You know, everybody thought, oh, it's a ThinkPad. You know, it's made by IBM. It's American as apple pie. But Lenovo is a mainland Chinese company. They've been on the banned list for the Department of Defense for quite a long time. So purchasing agents, contracting officers, or what they're actually called, have a banned product list, and we've been working with it for decades and decades. Lots and lots of stuff on that list already. Now, having said this, as I transitioned out of the classified world and into the commercial world, I got to work with Huawei in various locations. I sadly cannot share what actually happened because I'm still under a non-disclosure for it. But shall we say there are quite a few network engineers out in the world that haven't trusted Huawei for quite a while. Their management is trying to be good, but their low and mid-level managers seem to still be interested in doing some stuff. It's going to be interesting to see how this goes. Huawei and ZTE both have had equipment that various organizations have proven unequivocally that they phone home, which is probably what was going on with the FCC. Now, interestingly enough, the FBI has known about a lot of these things that I'm under non-disclosure for. We're not sure why. Nothing more has been done. But it's going to be interesting. Hytera Hikvision have been on the banned list for police departments for, I don't know, probably about a half a dozen years that I know of. In fact, some of the larger video management systems will no longer support Hikvision in an effort to push people away from them. So this is going to be really, really interesting. And I just think the FCC ban is interesting, that it's one of the least powerful ways the federal government has of doing a ban. But it's the most far reaching, because that's actually one of the certifications, you know, FCC certifications is one of the bigger ones that consumers actually look at. So I don't know what it's going to be like. I'm not privy to what the C-suite's talking about, but there has been a lot of shenanigans, and I just wish I could share, but I can't. I'll just say this. There's been a lot of shenanigans been going on, and I personally would never buy any of that equipment myself.
I hear you. Well, Curtis, I want to throw this to you before we move on to the guest. I mean, obviously, we covered in the blips a little bit about the Commerce Department going up against China here. They're blocking it both from the manufacturing side and import-export side. FCC blocking devices from ever being kind of coming to the U.S. or being sold in the U.S. It seems like to me like this is just a global shield to prevent China from impacting the global market, national security, and essentially here forcing the industry to move forward with self-reliance. Is that something that we're going to be able to survive?
Well, self-reliance is hard because there are areas in which we are not reliant, chips being the primary one.
Right.
It's an interesting market because we talked about the ban on shipping chip manufacturing equipment to China. Most of the chip manufacturing equipment does come from America, but it's shipped to other places where the chips are actually manufactured, which come back. And when you get to global markets and global communication networks, we are not going to be able to have a global network free of this equipment. Why? Because China has been using their national pocketbook to subsidize network construction and infrastructure construction in many parts of the world. Developing nations in Africa, Central and Southeast Asia, to a lesser extent, South America, all have been getting large infusions of money from China with the proviso that they turn around and spend much of it with Chinese contractors and Chinese vendors. So if you look at the national telecom networks in Southeast Asia, in Africa, you find Huawei equipment all over the place. And those networks interconnect with our networks. Now, we can do everything we want to keep the equipment from any given vendor from being used in the United States. But that doesn't mean we're never going to interact with that equipment, and no part of our communications is ever going to ride on that equipment. So it's, I think, a meaningful statement by our government, but we need to be realistic about just how big the impact is going to be.
I agree. Only time will tell. Thanks, Curtis. Thank you, Chibert. Well, folks, you know, I think it's enough of that. We definitely want to get into the guests because we have a lot of interesting topics to talk about. But before we do have to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech. and that's Melissa. Melissa is a leading provider of global data quality and address management solutions. Poor data quality can cost an organization an average of $15 million each year. Don't waste your marketing dollars, please. Be sure to manage your budgets effectively and smart, as the longer poor quality data stays in your system, the more losses you can accumulate. To ensure your business is successful, your customer information needs to be accurate and as high quality data as you can, which will save you money. Now, there's another side to the accurate data: customer service. If you address someone with the wrong name or verify the wrong address when dealing with an already frustrated customer, things go from bad to worse. Well, Melissa recently partnered with IDPal to launch Melissa ID for seamless contact verification in real time. Melissa ID is unique, fully customizable, out-of-the-box SaaS solution using a multi-layered approach that includes biometrics, facial matching, liveness testing, address verification, and document checks for automated identity verification. Backed by Melissa's 37 and more years in address standardization, correction, and verification, this new app offers coverage of over 6,000 identification documents across 200 countries and jurisdictions. Melissa ID is ideal for all types of businesses charged with reducing costs associated with customer acquisition, operations, fulfillment, and fraud. With Melissa, you'll reduce risk, ensure compliance, and keep customers happy. Protect your data from decay with 2.1 billion clean, validated records. Ensure compliance in areas of anti-money laundering, AML, politically exposed persons, and Bank Secrecy Act. Score and target customers with detailed demographic and firmographic data appends. Complete customer records, add missing names, addresses, phone numbers, and email addresses. Plus, they undergo independent security audits, and they're SOC 2, HIPAA, and GDPR compliant. Duplicate information hurts your bottom line. Melissa's data quality suite will help eliminate clutter and duplicates, increasing the accuracy of the database, reducing postage and mailing costs. Melissa has batch addressing, cleansing process, an entire address list for accuracy and completeness. Identify verification. You can reduce risk, ensure compliance, and keep customers happy. Geocoding enrichments. You can convert addresses into longitude and latitude coordinates. Plus email verification. Remove up to 95% of bad email addresses from your database. Plus you have lookups app. That's right. It's on iOS and Google to search addresses, verify social security numbers, access detailed property data, and more right at your fingertips. Make sure your customer contact data is up to date. Try Melissa's APIs in the developer portal. It's easy to log on, sign up, and start playing in the API sandbox 24/7. Get started today with 1,000 records cleaned for free at melissa.com/twit. That's melissa.com/twit. And we thank Melissa for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's my favorite part of the show where we actually get to bring in a guest to drop some knowledge on the Twire Riot. And today I have Lori McVitie. She's a distinguished engineer with F5. We're really excited to have you on. Welcome to the show, Lori.
Thanks. Really excited to be here.
So now, I know the hosts are no strangers to you, so I wanted to make sure we just got a couple questions in here, and then I'll bring them right back in. We'll have a roundtable discussion. But I wanted to start it out with the question around the fact that our audience has an experience spectrum. A lot of them like to hear people's origin stories. Can you maybe take us through a journey through tech and what brought you to F5?
All right. So not my actual origin story, like the New Year's Eve in the car.
Okay. Right.
All right. So I started out as a developer. I did the rounds around a lot of different industries. I job hopped a lot until I landed as an IT architect, and then somehow found my way into publishing, where we tested products and then wrote words about them. I was really good at the testing, not so good at the writing words back then. But over long years, I got better at both and eventually moved over to the dark side, where they have really good cookies. And joined F5 and have been there now for 16 years doing a lot of different things, technical marketing, product management, finally landed in the office of the CTO, where I focus primarily on technology strategy.
Fantastic. Now, we talk a lot about digital transformation on this show. We've had a lot of guests on that talk about the challenges there, the fact that, you know, organizations are still finding it challenging, but they're trying to do it very quickly, especially in the last couple of years. The one thing that they find hard, even today, is the concept of multi-cloud, supporting different clouds for different reasons or moving between clouds. Now, I've been hearing this term. It's been out for a while, but I've been starting to hear it even more. Super cloud. Can you maybe take us through what that is and what, if it, is it really a reality here?
Wow, is it a reality? I think it's starting to be in some places, little pockets, little pieces of it. But ultimately, you know, super cloud is this architectural idea that you can put a layer of abstraction across clouds that allows you to interface with any of them, right? You could provision a resource in any of them without having to understand Cloud A's specific set of APIs or workflows. You can put it in Cloud B, and again, you wouldn't have to worry about what's going on under the hood. And this is in response to that complexity that you manage, because a lot of that ties back to different cloud consoles, different sets of APIs, different workflows. It's, you know, it's a crazy world out there, and it's really hard on mostly on ops, right? Trying to deal with, how do I manage this? How do I monitor it? How do I secure it in a consistent way when I'm trying to use multiple clouds? So this is kind of that response. Is it real yet? There are forms of it. Some people call it distributed cloud. I know David Linthicum started with Meta Cloud. A few different terms for it, but they're all coalescing around that same concept. Let's manage the complexity we cannot get rid of.
Now, is this like a standardization process? Is there like a company out there that's trying to achieve that, or is it just basically saying, hey, AWS, Azure, Google, get together and figure out a way to make this a reality?
No, we tried that about 10-15 years ago. We tried to do that with the Infrastructure 2.0 working group. We got together from all these different vendors. Google was there, AWS was there, and we talked through it, and then we just dropped it because there just wasn't really an appetite. There's no impetus for any cloud provider really to conform to someone else's model of how they should operate. So it's really difficult to try to standardize that by saying, hey, you adopt it. So that's why I think this, right, the abstraction, a layer above approach is probably the one that will, you know, finally work, because that's the only way to really deal with it.
Right. So I guess the question next is, what are organizations doing today? Like, how are they managing something like this? Obviously, it's a challenge, especially at the DevOps layer. What are they doing to help at least mitigate some of the risk and some of the challenges there?
Wow, they're not. a lot of them aren't. A lot of them are throwing their hands up in frustration. A lot of them outsource for that skill set. And a lot of them are just dealing with it, right? They have multiple teams, and they're siloed now, right? We have an Amazon team, and we have a Google team, and then we have our, you know, private cloud team, and we all do our own thing, and we don't really interoperate even in our own company. And that's part of the bigger kind of fallout from, right, multi-cloud complexity, is that you fragment your IT operations, and you can't get any benefit out of that. It's really hard. It just causes more problems, additional costs. You don't know what's going on. Try doing an inventory. What do you got over there? Right. And a lot of the companies today that are suddenly being surprised by, cloud bills, some of that comes from that disconnect that they can't get a picture of, hey, what am I spending on cloud? Well, you have to go to each team and you have to figure it out.
Right. Now, I think if an organization, let's say an organization is starting out, and they're starting out and they're saying, okay, I'm going to move my application to the cloud, and I'm going to, digitally transform it, host it in the cloud. Is there something they can do right now to make it easier for them if they do need to say, okay, I'm going to move this whole cluster from this cloud to this cloud, or I'm going to move this network, or I'm going to expand my VNet to be across clouds or something like that. So that at least way their architecture makes it a little easier if they ever do need to go across cloud or make it even hybrid.
Wow. The easiest way is not to, I'm going to get in trouble for this eventually, but I mean, the easiest
way
is, I know it's coming, but it's the truth, right? If you're developing an app, whether it's a cloud native or container native, or just you want to put an app in the cloud and you start integrating with services from that cloud, that's technical debt. That's architectural debt. And you are not going to be able to pay that off and move easily. So you're going to be stuck, right? That's right there, right? You are basically putting tethers into that cloud that are going to keep you there because of the cost to try and rewrite that or refactor it and move it to a different cloud. So that's probably the biggest thing you can not do is don't get dependent on these services that you may not be able to use in another cloud.
Makes sense. I want to bring my co-host back in because one, they're chomping at the bit, and one, I'm sure that they're probably excited to ask questions as well. So, Curtis Cheever, I want to bring you guys back in. Who wants to go first?
Well, I have a couple that I want to ask, and it's based on some things that you just said. Because on the one hand, we know that every company is putting at least some of its application infrastructure in the cloud. If you have more than 4 employees, you're not doing everything on-prem. So you're going to the cloud. And my question with all these abstraction layers, as you said, knowing what you've got is a challenge. When you go to RSA, when you go to Black Hat, when you go to any of these, the word visibility is on every other booth. So do we just have to get used to a world in which we're supposed to secure all that stuff over there without really knowing what it is? Or are there answers to figuring out what actually lives within your defined infrastructure?
There are answers. I don't think people are looking for them right now because you're right. The focus is more on, I need to know about performance. I need to know about security. I need to know about, costs. I need to know about these things. So all of the visibility, the observability efforts today are really around those operational details. So there isn't as much effort or attention being spent on, hey, can you tell me what I have? Like, how many applications do I actually have? How many APIs are actually running? What, services am I using? No one's really doing that. If we go back, 10, 15 years, NPM was partially about, hey, give me a map of my network. Go out there and survey everything and tell me what I have so that I know what I have to secure and what my assets are. And organizations need to go through that exercise, but there's not a lot of tools to help them today. So I don't think we have to, live with it forever, but until someone pays attention to it and solves that problem, we have to live with it.
Well, I love the idea of living with stuff until we can invent new stuff. It seems like I've been hearing this for a while. Another thing that we were hearing, and when you go again to the industry conferences, you get a big dose of this, is the idea, your big three public clouds all say, oh, we're happy to work with the other public clouds. You can have applications that go across cloud. We're fine with that. With the subtext of we're fine with it as long as we're the top of the pile, as long as we're sort of the cloud that manages all of these other lesser clouds. Again, is that as good as it's going to get? Or do you foresee a way where there can be some sort of grand, Switzerland of cloud management systems that is the one that, you know, you go in and dip your toes into the digital Lake Lucerne and everything is happy underneath.
Isn't that a beautiful dream, right? The single pane of glass.
The single pane of glass.
The managers of clouds. Oh, it'll be a beautiful world when we get that, right? I mean, we never got it for networks. We didn't get it for, you know, for apps. We didn't get it, right? No technology has ever managed to produce, right, that single pane that we all want. I mean, that's ultimately, yes, that would solve the problem. It would be beautiful. But I don't think we're ever going to get there. I don't. And I think part of that is just, again, right, well, why, right? I mean, why would we, you know, support something that lets you use somebody else's product? I mean, that's just, hey, that's business. But the other one is it changes so fast. I mean, look at how fast technology has changed just in the last few years. Imagine trying to, right, keep up with that in that single, right, console, right, or that single system. You'd have to have people working 24/7, just trying to integrate all and change and test. And oh my goodness, what would you do? So I don't think it's feasible. I think we all want it. I don't think we're ever going to get it.
Well, that's a cheerful assessment. I appreciate that.
You're bumming me out, Curtis. It's just bumming me out.
Well, it's my job. You know, it's been the basis of the professional relationship we've had for a long time. So
I know. You're always just right there, right? Find all the.
Well, you know, I think one of the things we are in an industry where we get to a certain architectural picture. And we decide that that's the way, you know, we have reached the ultimate. I remember client server was that way. Oh, client server is what a beautiful architecture. What a wonderful way to be, which it was right up until the time that the cloud came along. And then you don't hear client server anymore. So I suppose my question is, do you see the cloud, as we define it today, being the sort of architecture that we're going to use for the rest of our careers? Or, you know, are we going to see that pendulum swing back again? I'll have to admit, I was amused to see someone talking about more powerful edge devices. And they started on this, and I said, isn't that just a PC? But, you know, what do you think? Are we where we're going to be for a while, or are we still evolving into what, you know, the perfect application development infrastructure will become?
Oh, it's still developing, and it's changing fast, right? Even at the edge, right? That's still a very much a forming market. And when you combine, you know, Web3, because you have to say Web3, right? Decentralized, right? Just break up all the things. But when you combine all those things, you're starting to see all sorts of changes already being driven into the models about the patterns that we use to develop applications, how they communicate, where they communicate, and where they're located, right? There's edge and there's compute, but then there's also peer-to-peer models at the edge. And then there's this idea of Web3 and decentralization, where it's not just the application or, you know, end user device, but then also the data gets distributed and your identity. So all of these things are still forming and they're rapidly changing what the architectures look like. So, you know, you're good now and you'll probably be good for several years, but it's going to change. And that's one of the things that we see is that, you know, when our enterprises put together their architecture and they design it and they think about technology, they think about how can we build a network and an application infrastructure and an environment that is resilient. But resiliency means the ability to bounce back after something happens or after something changes. And in the future, the rate of change is so much that you have to be building for adaptability instead. Right, where you can adapt to the changes, incorporate them, take advantage of them, find new opportunities, and be able to keep moving at that same pace instead of being like hit by a truck and stop. Like you're like, I don't even know what to do, right? What's next? So it's not going to stop anytime soon. The rate of change is just too fast right now.
Well, I'm going to ask the crystal ball question. Kurt and I got a chance to write a book for CRC Press a decent amount of time ago on cloud computing. And one of the things that a prediction that I brought up was quoting from Arthur C. Clarke. He was talking in his book, Fountains of Paradise, about being able to log into a terminal. He still called it a terminal. And he happened to be at a Buddhist monastery and was still able to run flight dynamics for a space elevator to show the abbot. The point being, do you think we're ever going to get to the point where we can shop around, you know, saying, okay, I want to do this task, but I don't have the software. Who's got it? And I've got to run payroll and I want to shop it around to someone that's going to give me the best rate. Obviously, the big three cloud vendors don't like this because they want you in their neighborhood. But it's going to be a third party, kind of like what happened in the DSIM world, you know, the server, KVM management, so forth. Avasant tried to put a box in front of that so that you could manage all the system management, all the hardware management in a common interface. Is this what you're talking about? Are we going to see a product like that, say an add-on to the big IP?
No, okay. That's not what it's about. Yeah, at all. Really. Okay. I mean, you might see something like distributed cloud that might grow to be able to do that, but it involves platforms, it involves APIs, mm-hmm. right? You have to normalize the application environment, right? So when you deploy that cluster, it's got to be in a normalized environment that can run in any kind of cloud. So you have to either, you know, find one of those, and they don't really quite exist yet, or you have to wrap it in some sort of platform. And you also have to account for, you know, it's not all cloud. There is still a significant presence on premises, and there's going to continue to be for some time. So when you talk about multi-cloud, you also have to start thinking about how do I incorporate that if we're truly going to make this work. So some kind of an abstraction platform that enables you to move those workloads around seamlessly is really what, you know, we're going for. Is that going to happen next year? Probably not. Is it going to be on a box? No, that's not going to work. There needs to be hardware because all software needs hardware, but it's not going to be a piece of hardware that you can deploy and magically get this, right? It's going to take a whole bunch of systems working in concert to be able to orchestrate that kind of movement and that kind of portability.
So what kinds of things do we see? Obviously, we're going to have like what I've been seeing products where people are saying, well, we're going to have your web application firewalls and things like that, and it's going to be a cloud app. Do you think a lot of these services are going to become just that, apps that you add on and you bolt on the abstraction, whether it's an AWS, Google, or Azure cloud?
Yeah. You've seen that, you know, since around 2013, 2014, when people started to go, hey, this microservices architecture and containers is pretty cool. And you could see that it had like this gravitational pull on things that were traditionally deployed in the network, things like the load balancing and WAF and other kinds of services. So, right, it pulled some to it. Now, the thing about a lot of the security services is that they are going at the edge and they are going in the cloud because they need to be able to scale to volumes that just can't be met on premises without a lot of network hardware and a lot of cost, but also because it makes the most sense architecturally to stop an attack as soon as you can, which means get it as close to the bad actor as you can, right? Push it out to the edge so that they're stopped before it gets anywhere near your network. And you say bandwidth, you say, you know, you can do the ROI calculations and all that, but it's architecturally sound to put those out there. So you see a lot of the security services are moving to edge or cloud, and that's how they're offered. And also because of the nature of those services, they're all proxy based. So you can put them pretty much anywhere, right? They're not attached to the application. They're not in the architecture or bolted on. So they live separately, and architecturally, you can put them in different places. So that's going to continue to grow, right? Those kind of services, you know, at the edge, if you will. It just, you have to start looking at which services make sense architecturally to put there and which ones don't. Right. It doesn't make a lot of sense to take an ingress controller, rip it out of a Kubernetes cluster and put it somewhere across the world. Why would you do that? Right. Architecturally, that doesn't make sense. So, right. Those are going to stay with the application and move around mm-hmm. as opposed to something like a WAF or API security that might reside at the edge because it makes sense to run there.
True. And so let's go shake the magic eight ball. In the Laurie McVitie view of the world, what would a, you know, what should corporations actually be doing? You know, there's so much noise in the press. There's so much noise in social media about what people say you should be doing. Let's go throw one more opinion. What should corporations, what should organizations be prepping for? How, you know, what's the homework that you think someone should be doing to prepare for the super cloud and digital transformation?
Wow. So we wrote a whole book about that. That was the premise of the book that we wrote. Then we looked out and we said, wow, all of this technology, in order to be able to change, you need to look at your entire enterprise architecture, and not the network, not the diagrams and how things are wired together, but how you use and leverage technology in conjunction with the business to serve the business, right? To produce business capabilities, because all of this is changing, right? A digital business is not a traditional business. So the interplay between technology and business becomes very different. And so the enterprise architecture needs to be, you know, we would say modernized. So the best thing someone could do right now is to step back and look at what they have and understand what their business is trying to do and how they can make sure that all of the pieces of their architecture are actually going to be able to support those needs and provide those capabilities so the business can survive, or even better, thrive, right, in a digital world.
All right. So we talked about a book. We had blog entries. Where should our viewers go to go and hear pearls of wisdom from Laurie McVitie and the F5 team?
Not their pearls, maybe more like acorns, really tasty acorns, but acorns.
Okay.
So they can find me on Twitter at LMcVitie, or they can find me on F5.com. I blog out there. And, you know, I can give you the actual link, but I think it's like all things Laurie with hyphens, something like that. But that'll pull up all my writings. I still write at Network Computing once a month. So that goes out there, and that's always fun. Otherwise, I'm just, you know, I'm on the internet. I'm out there. It's all good.
Fantastic. Well, Laurie, it's amazing how time flies when you're having fun. It's so great having you on the show. Since we're running low on time, can maybe tell the folks at home where they can learn more about F5 and, of course, maybe what's going on with F5 in the coming weeks or what's been going on?
Sure. You can find F5 at F5.com. And they're on Twitter and they're on LinkedIn. And I think, you know, every other social media that you might be on, you know, what's been going on? Wow. We've been doing all sorts of stuff around security and distributed cloud, building out those services. Right. Nginx just had some really great product release with API management, especially, you know, crossing that bridge between operations and development. So it's really awesome. I got a demo even. It was really cool. So we've been doing a lot of different things, but, as you know, focusing on APIs and services and, you know, that edge platform, building that out.
Fantastic. Thanks again, Laurie, for being here. Well, folks, you've done it again. You sat through another hour of the best thing enterprise and IT podcast in the universe. So definitely tune your podcatcher to Twyatt. I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to my co-host, starting with our very own Mr. Curtis Franklin. Curtis, what's going on with you in the coming weeks, and where can people find you?
Well, lots more writing, lots of research. I'll be at on darkreading.com over with the Omdia tab. I've got some stuff happening on Omdia. I've got a number of custom projects I'm working on, and I'm getting ready for Maker Faire Orlando, which happens November 5th and 6th at the Central Florida Fairgrounds. So plenty to keep me busy. And when my copious spare time, I'll be thinking about things that I can talk about here on Twiet, and would love it if people look me up over on Twitter at KG4GWA and shoot me a direct message if there's something that they are very interested in.
Thanks, Curtis, for being here. We also thank our very own Mr. Brian Chee. That's right, Cheeber. What's going on for you in the coming weekend? Where can people find you?
Well, you're welcome to throw me questions, comments, suggestions, whatever you want. I'm on Twitter, ADVNETLAB, Advanced Net Lab. You're also welcome to throw me email. I'm Cheebert, spelled Cheebert, at twit.tv. Or you're welcome to also throw email to Twiet at twit.tv. I'm actually following Adam the Fantup. He's been doing some interesting things with AI-generated art. The Orlando Maker Faire is going to be doing AI-generated video, which is going to be interesting. It's something diffusion. Oh, I'm getting old. Anyway, stable diffusion. Thank you. So the idea is we're trying to track down enough hardware to be able to run it. I actually have an old HP Z600, which I found out isn't quite there because the video cards that they suggest want PCIe version 4 and the Z600 is PCIe version 3. Who would think a multi-$1,000 workstation class machine would get old that fast? Darn. Anyway, so we're hopefully going to have a AI art contest with some interesting prizes and so forth. And for those that can hit us and can visit us in Central Florida, I strongly recommend November 5th and 6th at the Central Florida Fairgrounds. We're going to have all kinds of really cool things. And I'm really and truly praying that my back is going to be better so that I can wander around and help out and do all kinds of cool stuff at the greatest show and tell on earth.
Thank you, Cheebert. It's great having you here. Well, folks, we also have to thank you as well. You're the person who drops in each and every week to watch and to listen to our show to get your enterprise and IT goodness. So I want to make it easy for you to watch and listen and catch up on your enterprise and IT news. So go to our show page right now, twit.tv/Twiet. There you'll find all those amazing episodes, of course, the back episodes, the show notes, the co-host information, guest information, links of the stories we do in the show. But more importantly, next to those videos there, you get those helpful subscribe and download links. Support the show by getting an audio version, video version of your choice. Listen on any one of your devices or any one of your podcast applications because we're on all of them. Definitely subscribe and support the show. Plus, you've also probably heard of Club Twit. That's right. It's a members only ad-free podcast service with a bonus Twit Plus feed that you can't get anywhere else. And it's only $7 a month. And there's a lot of great things that come with Club Twit. In fact, one of them is exclusive access to the members-only Discord channels of servers. Now, that is, of course, the fact that you can chat with hosts, producers. You have separate discussions in all the great channels that are in there. Plus, also have some amazing special events that I love to partake in. Lots of fun discussions there, so definitely check that out. Join Club Twit. Be part of that fun and movement. Go to twit.tv/Club Twit. Of course, also Club Twit offers corporate group plans as well. That's right. It's a great way to give your team access to our ad-free tech podcasts that are out there. The plans start with 5 members at a discounted rate of $6 each per month, and you can add as many seats as you like. And this is a great way for your IT department, your sales department, your developers, your tech teams to stay on top and up to date to all of our podcasts that are out there. And just like regular memberships, they can join the Twit Discord server as well and get that Twit Plus bonus feed as well. So twit.tv/Club Twit. Now, after you subscribe, you know, definitely impress your family members, your coworkers, your friends, the gift of TWI, because we talk a lot about fun tech topics on this show, and I guarantee they will find it fun and interesting as well. So definitely have them subscribe and support the show. Now, after you subscribe, remember, we do this show live. That's right. Come check out the live streams at 1:30 p.m. Pacific Fridays at live.twit.tv. There we'll have all the streams that you can choose from. Come see how the pizza's made, all the banter that we have, all the fun that we have here on Twit. Definitely check it out live. And of course, if you're going to watch the show live, you got to jump into the infamous IRC channel as well at irc.twit.tv. There you can post with all of the fun characters there that are there each and every week. Of course, we have some new characters in every week as well. And we have a lot of great show titles in there. There we have some show titles ideas. We have some great conversations. Of course, sometimes you can get some really great questions and even veer the show in a particular direction because of it. So definitely check that out and be part of the IRC channel, irc.twit.tv. Definitely hit me up at twitter.com/LouMM. There I post my enterprise tidbits. Direct message me for show ideas. If you just want to have a conversation about technology, enterprise, coding, love coding, coding languages. I'm playing with Go right now. A lot of fun stuff. Of course, Microsoft Ignite's happening. So feel free to reach out and ask questions like, why is Office now Microsoft 365? Stuff like that. So definitely check that out and hit me up. Of course, hit me up on LinkedIn as well. I got some really great messages there as in the recent weeks, and I've got some great show ideas as well. So definitely hit me there. Of course, you want to know what I do during my normal work week at Microsoft, definitely hit out developers.microsoft.com/office. Maybe Microsoft 365 soon. And find the latest and greatest ways to actually customize your experience there. Make it more productive for you, your organization. Make it so you can have macros and share them with different people and have it cross-platform, do it in the cloud, that kind of thing. So definitely check out different ways to customize your experience there at that site. I also want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to Leo and Lisa. They continue to support This Week in Enterprise Tech each and every week, and we really couldn't do the show without them. Thank you for all their support over the years. And of course, all the engineers. Thank you to all the engineers and all the staff at Twit. And of course, also thank you to Mr. Brian Chi one more time, because he's not only our co-host, but he's also our tireless producer. Behind the scenes, he also does all the bookings and the plannings for the show. And we really couldn't do the show without him. So thank you, Chibert, again, for all of your support. Of course, before we sign out, we have to thank our editor for today, Mr. Anthony. He makes us look good after the fact. He cuts out all the blemishes and all the issues that we have, and of course all the blips we make. But we have to thank our TD today, our technical director. He's the talented Mr. Ant Pruitt. He does an amazing show called Hands-On Photography. And what's going on this week, because I'm ready to watch this week?
Well, thank you, Mr. Lou. This week I took a look at how you can use color to really just change the mood of your photos or your videos, whether you want to make it look nice and airy and happy like someone's working on a toy, or make it look a little gloomy like, what is this creep doing down in his basement? So play around with your color grading. Have a lot of fun with your art.
Looking forward to it. Thank you for everything and all your support. Until next time, I'm Louis Maresca, just reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep quiet.
Hey, I'm Rod Pyle, Editor-in-Chief of Ad Astra Magazine, and each week I join with my co-host to bring you This Week in Space, the latest and greatest news from the final frontier. We talk to NASA chiefs, space scientists, engineers, educators, and artists, and sometimes we just shoot the breeze over what's hot and what's not in space books and TV. And we do it all for you, our fellow true believers. So whether you're an armchair adventurer or waiting for your turn to grab a slot in Elon's Mars rocket, join us on This Week in Space and be part of the greatest adventure of all time. We'll be right back.